Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program. Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. On KiteLine, we hope to pass along those words across the prison walls.
Hello and welcome to KiteLine. Let's start out with some local and national prison-related news.
Muhammad Ali has just died at 74 years old. In 1972, he dedicated this poem to the prisoners who died in the Attica Uprising in New York State the year before. Better far from all I see, to die fighting to be free. What more fitting end could be?
Rapper Gucci Mane was released a few months early from an Indiana prison where he was serving a federal firearm sentence, his lawyer said recently. Attorney Drew Feindling said the music artist, whose real name is Roderick Davis, was released from the federal correction institution in Terre Haute, Indiana. Davis, 36, was released early after a series of motions filed a few months ago said the rapper hadn't received credit for previous time served. The original computation didn't give him that credit, Feindling said. We had to file a series of motions. Ultimately, the judge signed an order acknowledging that he's entitled to that credit. Then the Bureau of Prison immediately gave him that credit. Davis was expected to be released on September 20th. A call-in has been organized to protest censorship at the Pendleton Correctional Facility in Pendleton, Indiana. Internal affairs at PCF have been confiscating political material, newsletters, and other publications being sent to inmates. They claim that the newsletters consist of, quote, unauthorized offender-to-offender contact, end quote, because some of the publications contain articles, letters, or stories written by other inmates. They claim that the inmates seeing these printed materials constitutes a security risk, and they confiscate the newsletters and magazines. This is a clear violation of the inmates' First Amendment rights. They have the right to access political material and prison newsletters. Rules against offender-to-offender communication were designed to keep inmates from writing directly to each other, not from contributing to publications that might be seen by other inmates. Some examples of the publications being censored are the Indiana Cure newsletter, Tulip newsletters, and the San Francisco Bay View. To participate in this call-in and protect the inmates' First Amendment rights, please call or email the following people. Lead Internal Affairs Investigator Hubert Duncan at 765-778-2107, extension 0, ask for Hubert Duncan. Again, that's 765-778-2107, extension 0 for operator, and ask for Hubert Duncan. Or you can email him at hduncan@idoc.in.gov. The Indiana Department of Corrections Commissioner Bruce Lemon at 317-232-5711. Again, that's 317-232-5711. Executive Assistant Stephanie Lightfoot's email is slightfoot@idoc.in.gov. A suggested script, as well as more information on who to contact, can be found at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org, or on Facebook at facebook.com/kitelineradio.
I'm Kevin, and I'm here with Nicole Siegel for the first bit of a multi-part series on Prison 101.
Could you speak on the role prisons play in our society?
Prisons play a very important role in our society, unfortunately, because the role they play is mostly negative. But I think this is a tremendously important question because sometimes when we think about prisons as a problem, we think that they need to be changed or reformed, that they're not actually working. You know, they're broken or something. And I think it's a much stronger perspective to come at it with the understanding that prisons are not broken, that they are actually functioning to do quite a number of things in our society that we ask them to do. I think the social function of prison is maybe primary. That is to say, we use prisons to address social problems that we choose not to solve. For example, in the 1950s and 60s, when critics of our mental health care system began to multiply, there was a big movement to deinstitutionalize, right? To not put people that we considered mentally deviant in asylums or institutions. And so a big movement of deinstitutionalization happened. However, we chose not to follow up with the resources that people who were being kicked out of where they were living needed. And so instead, what has happened is we've criminalized mental illness and we've put the people who suffer from it in prison. Another example, obviously, is drugs. Instead of choosing treatments, we choose criminalization. And there are a number of other social issues that we choose to deal with prisons instead of solutions that would actually address people's needs in a more humane way. A second function of prisons in U.S. society is an economic function. The U.S. switched from a manufacturing to a service economy in the last quarter of the 20th century and starting in the 1970s. So a very large number of people who did not have the resources to train themselves for jobs in the service economy or in fire, finance, insurance, and real estate, or in the professional managerial class, right, to become doctors or lawyers or professors, they were idled. They were idled by the shift in from manufacturing to service. And so we use prisons to control that population, which was made idle and unnecessary by a global change in the U.S.'s economic role in the world. And then the third function of prisons in U.S. society today, I think, is an ideological function. And this one is the hardest to grasp, and one that people, I think, often like to imagine as some kind of conspiracy. The media makes us think a certain way, but I think prisons play a profound role in making us think in certain ways, in allowing us to imagine that the world is divided into us and them, into people who deserve every crack at first-class citizenship, and people who can be relegated to a very marginal second-class, you know, worthy populations and those deserving of pariah status, or the way the French historian and theorist Michel Foucault put it, whom to make live and whom to let die. And they also function to allow us to imagine that these divisions are deserved, right? That our economic, that our social hierarchies are the result of certain people's virtues and other people's faults or bad decisions, as we like to say. And I think these are tremendously destructive divisions, and they rest on older divisions that have lots of use in history, and they lend themselves to newer divisions, and you can see them being applied now, for example, to immigrants, to the idea of the terrorist. So these ideological fictions are extremely powerful. They have great material consequence, and prisons are really critical in helping to distribute and reinforce those.
You're listening to Kite Line on WFHB Community Radio, broadcasting from 98.1 FM Bloomington, 91.3 FM South Central Indiana, 100.7 FM Nashville, and 106.3 Ellettsville. Now we'll hear from Jacoby Williams, associate professor at Indiana University Bloomington and author of the book From the Bullet to the Ballot. Williams spoke on the history of the Black Panther Party and policing at a talk this spring entitled Fighting Mass Incarceration, a Strategy Discussion.
Black police officers are just more immoral, got more constraint. Hell no, they kill black people all the time, right? But you always turn your TV on and you see white officers or black officers killing black people all the time. So when we talk about Black Lives Matter, this is what we mean. Now, it's not because those black officers are more moral. They just know they can't get away with it. They know there's going to be some accountability. They have more restraint. And nobody cares when you kill our kids. And that's the emphasis there is kids. When we're talking about Trayvon, we're talking about Mike Brown, whoever. These are kids. They're children. Tamir Rice, they're kids. They're killing our children. So 50 years later, here we have these same dynamics, right? And so these are not conspiracy theories. These are not people playing a race card. These are not folks crying foul like there's no real issue there. These are real tangible issues. So I do challenge you all. Find a person of color on TV for killing some of the white kids as a mistake because he feared for his life or because he thought his cell phone was a gun. You won't find it anywhere, right? It just doesn't exist because even those officers, it's an institution. We keep forgetting that the police, it's an institution. Now, how does all tie into mass incarceration? All these things are intertwined. The way in which police are an institution. These prisons are institutions. And so when you find people resisting the police, people like myself and others, yeah, I was in Ferguson throwing tear canisters back at police, just like everybody else. As a citizen, not as an employee of Indiana University. I need my job. just me on my own, right? Be clear about that. I need my job. But in doing and carrying out those acts of resistance, that's the community's response to an institution. The institution is the problem. And when we talk about institutional racism, this is what it means. There's power and privilege given to one group at the expense of another. And so when I see all these black folks getting killed and it's not happening on the other side, there's some power and privilege you're giving to one group at the expense of another. And so the response is always to attack the institutions. So in the 60s, you had 6 or 7 race riots all over this country. When I say race riots, and I don't use that term, that's the mainstream term. We use uprising rebellions. You never see an instance where black people are mad, we go march into the suburbs, the white neighborhoods, stop beating shit out of white people. No, it happens. No, you see the community fighting the institution, the police. The police are an institution. Regardless of their color, they're an institution. You always see a dynamic between the community and the police. So when the folks on this mainstream CNN, 24-hour news work, say, oh, this is a race riot going on. Where? I don't see black people attacking people. I see people responding to an institution. And institutions can be dismantled. Institutions can be changed.
That was Indiana University professor Jacoby Williams speaking at a recent event entitled Fighting Mass Incarceration, a Strategy Discussion. For those of you just joining us, this is KiteLine on WFHB. Next, we go to a conversation with Laurel Kilpatrick, an activist involved with prison issues in Gary, Indiana.
My name is Laurel Kilpatrick. I'm a native of East Chicago, Indiana, and I'm a co-organizer with Black Lives Matter Gary, a member of the Saving Our Families Committee with Gary Christ United Methodist Church. The committee is out of Gary Christ United Methodist Church. I'm also a co-founder of Black Lives Matter Hammond. And other than that, adjunct lecturer of sociology, doing social justice work for quite a while now, and activist-y type stuff as well.
Wonderful. Could you tell me a little, give me a little bit of background on the immigrant detention center that was scheduled to be built in Gary?
Sure. So initially this was a project that the GEO group had tried to carry out in Hobart, Indiana. They actually secured purchasing land in Hobart, but due to the opposition that residents put up in Hobart, and also greatly aided by the fact that the land that they had purchased was marked as, I believe it was marshland and therefore protected, and you couldn't build, I believe it was a residential facility on that land, they weren't able to actually use it for the detention center. So they moved to Gary. And it almost worked. Of course, they promised a great amount of money to the city officials. It would have virtually, I think they tried to sell it as virtually being free to the city.
The plan moved to Gary, and then what was the timeline once the plan switched over to Gary?
The original offer was made October-ish of 2015. That's kind of when we first heard about it. Activists from Hobart came to a Black Lives Matter meeting and notified us of this and kind of informed us on it. This is not something that we had heard about. This was right around the time of the Gary mayoral election. A news story came out that the mayor had put out probably 2 days after the election that this was even on the table. But this wasn't something that was heard about until after it was almost a done deal. And I'm pretty sure they were not at all suspecting the pushback they got. And just to tell you, by the way, the threat is not over. We just heard the GEO is still courting different ministerial groups. And basically what that means is they've offered money to different churches, to different pastor or minister associations to either listen to them pitch this idea or become vocal advocates of the immigration prison coming to the area. So they're still in the process of doing this. So apparently, this isn't over. And just the way that the governance works, technically, what was voted down is a direct result of public pressure. What was voted down was a continued reading of the proposal.
Oh.
So I think that that's a very specific technicality to note, because a lot of things that happen, you know, especially in these types of areas where people are disempowered and disenfranchised with the whole process, is that they don't know the language, right, that these city councils or the you know, state governments or even federal governments are using. They don't know the legal language, the parliamentary language. So that was one of the things that we wanted to keep in people's mind, is that, you know, it's not like they voted down the proposal. No, that's not what happened. They voted down the second reading of the proposal in the council. So the proposal could come back in another form. They wouldn't have even have to change that much of it for it to be considered a separate proposal.
Wow.
And it's, like I said, I mean, it's dirty politics, basically. It was, you know, the way that they garnered the support that they got is they literally paid people. You know, they paid, you know, some young folks to hold up signs and kind of be aggressive to the opposition. A couple of the young folks were my former students. That's how I know from what they said. And they, in turn, started coming to Black Lives Matter meetings because they said, we thought that, you know, we were told that this group was trying to bring jobs and that you all were trying to stop them from bringing jobs. And they were saying, you know, I need a job, you know, so why would you all try to stop them from bringing jobs? But it's that personal connection that kind of cleared the air with that, you know, and it's really terrible. So they went from paying these young people to paying people that, you know, people who were just kind of hanging around town, whether they were, you know, homeless or had issues, you know, with one addiction or another. They paid another group of people to be kind of vocally aggressive at another meeting, and it almost turned into a physical issue. You know, got a little physical, and it was terrible. You know, and that's one of the things that we said. We said this is the kind of discord that this group, that this project is bringing to the city.
So you all found out about this in October of 2015. You had a conversation, and from there, some members of the group and then other groups got together and went and disrupted a board meeting and demonstrated against the proposal.
Yes, the zoning board proposal. There had to be special permission given from the city to grant the prison to build such a large residential facility in an industrial area. So that had to go to the zoning board first before it went to the city council. So the first time, it got stopped by the zoning board. So the meeting didn't even proceed, and the prison group ended up withdrawing their petition.
Okay. And then what happened the next time?
Yes. Someone recommended that it go from the zoning board directly to the city council. And there's tremendous, what do you call it, conflict of interest. There you go. There's tremendous conflict of interest in all this. For instance, the legal advisor for the Gary City Council is a member of the zoning board. That person was the only member to actually vote that the zoning board approved the proposal. That person, acting as the legal counsel for the Gary City Council, upheld a very, very unorthodox procedure that wasn't covered in Robert's Rules of Order. That I think the majority of the council voted against it going to a second reading, but then that person voted it to be heard. That the proposal be heard again. The council said that was okay when it didn't make sense to anybody. So there was a conflict of interest there. A voting member of the city council has a leg brace business. You know, the leg monitors when you're on house arrest.
Yeah.
He's in the business of producing those. That's a complete conflict of interest. Of course, the prison is going to be using those, right? I mean, it's a conflict of interest. You can't profit from the prison industrial complex and then vote on a measure that expands a prison industrial complex in a city.
Could you give some specific points for why the coalition opposed the immigrant prison?
So the opposition came in two major forms. It was a moral opposition. Excuse me. It was a moral opposition. And then it was also a more material economic opposition, right? The moral opposition, again, is participating in the for-profit imprisoning of individuals who have been declared illegal, when we believe that no individual is illegal, right? That doesn't exist. You're not illegal, or you're not just breaking the law by the fact that you're breathing and existing somewhere. There's a wider argument to be had about patterns of migration and why they happen that have to be completely ignored to talk about a person as being illegal. And also the morality of breaking apart families, of breaking apart communities, of the wider prison industrial complex that basically holds people for ransom. If you can't pay this amount in bail or this amount in damages, and you have to stay in this cell. So, you know, one of the issues was definitely opposition based on morality, it being just morally reprehensible what this group represented, right? And the second being like a more material economic disadvantage for the city. The fact that all of the things that the GEO group was promising were not true. They weren't going to come to fruition. They may have been offering a great deal of money for the city of Gary, but it would not have been a benefit overall for the people of the city of Gary. And that's very different. The interests of the politicians and the interests of the people. Usually, in most cases, everywhere, no matter what level of government, those two things seem to be very, very contradictory. So one of the main things, again, these jobs that were going to be available, the GEO group is known for contracting out jobs with specific agencies, bringing workers from all over. And not that anyone was against any worker from any place having a job. We were just pointing out the lie that those jobs would be earmarked for Gary residents. It wasn't true. They talked about the construction jobs. Well, this group also does prefabricated prisons, which is almost, you know, a little more complex than a Lego system, but they mostly already come built, right? And they're just being erected. So that's not true. And of course, after, they're not going to have any of these beds empty. And there was an information session where people were very, very aggressively asking these questions. And they were stumped. The GEO group representatives were stumped. If those beds lay empty, who's responsible for that? Who's responsible for the recoup of that investment? And of course, the city becomes responsible. And by the city, we mean the taxpayers, the people, the majority of which didn't even want this there in the first place. That's who becomes responsible for that. And as well, if those beds lay empty too long, then it's going to go real quick from an immigration detention facility to just a regular domestic detention facility. And likely, some of the residents of Gary are going to be inhabited in that prison, right? So that those are the main two points of opposition, the moral opposition and then the material economic opposition, showing how this was going to be yet another garbage investment for the city that the people were going to have to pay for, but that the politicians would come out great in because they would have collected all of their compliance money, which turned out to be true. You know, we had people come forward with statements that we didn't go public with people being just paid off, which isn't surprising.
Are there any other points that you'd really like to hit home?
Yeah, one of the things I really want to push home is that what was stated was that this push to build more of these immigrant detention facilities was mandated by the federal government, right? And I think that everybody is so caught up in the current elections, right? Who are we going to choose? Are we going to choose the person who uses blatant racism, the person who is a blatant corporatist, or the other person who, you know, is more lovable, but still going to be complicit in all these things because that's just the job requirement of the president of the United States, right? The president of a capitalist nation is going to uphold capitalism no matter what. And they may do it with a smile, but my goodness, they said that this is an edict from the federal government that more of these detention facilities be built. So that means it doesn't matter who's going to be president, right? It doesn't matter who is going to be president. This is a fact of life. Deportations are going to continue to occur, right? This is going to happen. So that's why it's not a done deal, because to a certain degree, we have to face reality. This place is going to be put somewhere. And just because it ends up not being put in Gary, that's not the victory, right? The victory is not that the detention center wasn't put in Gary. The victory, I think, is always in the fighting. I think the victory is always in the education and the enlightenment of people to see that they're two separate interests, right? They're the interests in your elected officials and the interests of the actual people who are suffering under the system. So I think that's the victory. But no, it's not a done deal. They're still talking to people. What's flying on the wind now in terms of the word is that they're looking for a different plot of land to put it on. And that was another thing, too. You know, I spoke at the I spoke at Break Free Midwest. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. Environmental rights, Break Free of Fossil Fuels, Midwest 2016. Yeah, it was in Whiting, Indiana. If you go to the website, you can see, you know, video clips of everybody speaking. And I spoke there as well. And my theme was to connect the dots between social justice and environmental justice, specifically racial justice and environmental justice. And talking about how one of the things with the GEO Group, one of the things they were proposing was that they were going to put all this money into the environmental cleanup of the area where they were going to build. And one of our points with Black Lives Matter, Gary, is that why does it take a prison company to put this money into, you know, cleaning the water or trying to detoxify the land for people to be able to live, you know, free of being poisoned? Why is that the only way this can be done, and holding the city officials responsible for it?
Hell yeah.
So that's one kind of major thing, the reason why we know this all isn't over. But another thing is that, talking about BLM and why we joined it, BLM Gary, all of our points, the reason that BLM Gary was created was Southern Initial Demand made to the city of Gary that had to do with police violence, that had to do with predatory traffic fines, that had to do with stopping the local and county sweeps, these house invasions with these sweeps, that had to do with more transparency in terms of policing, and definitely one of the ones we're focusing on now is the creation of a truly independent civilian review board to address instances of abuse of not just local Gary police, but also county police. And what the legislature of Gary, Indiana has done is that they sold the city to other police departments in other cities so they can police Gary and make money off of some of these predatory findings that they do. So, and I say all that to say that is the second biggest point, is that all of these things are connected, right? All of these things are connected. All of these struggles are connected. If you look at social activism, you're going to start seeing patterns in terms of people and organizations that are involved. Because injustice touches everybody. It touches every facet. And I think once more and more people become involved in fighting injustice, you're going to see a lot of the same issues coming up, no matter what the main focus is on. If it's environment, if it's prison, if it's police brutality, if it's women's rights, if it's women's reproductive rights, you know, you're going to see a lot of the same themes of racism, classism, and sexism, which really kind of boils down to a profit over people system. I think that's the biggest thing that we're all fighting.
Kiteline wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you someone affected by the prison system? If you or a family member have a story you want shared on the program, please email us at kitelineradio@gmail.com. We also welcome you to record something for us to put on the air. To record a message for the show or to send a message to a family member or loved one who's currently behind the walls of an Indiana prison, please call 812-269-2512 and record your message. The Midwest Pages to Prisoners Project is an all-volunteer effort that strives to encourage self-education among prisoners in the United States. To get involved, we encourage you to come to their volunteer hours to learn more. The volunteer hours are Sunday, 2 to 5 p.m., Monday, 6 to 9 p.m., Tuesday, 12 to 3 p.m., Wednesday, 3:30 to 6 p.m., and Thursday, 6 to 9 p.m. More information about Pages to Prisoners, donating, or helping out can be found at pagestoprisoners.org. Kiteline is solely responsible for the content here on the show. The views expressed on Kiteline do not necessarily express the opinions of WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program.